Hello and welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
Sean, you're me pal, and how are you doing today?
Super as always, me old fella.
Am I still giving you that 15 a week?
Actually, I believe it's been raised to $19 a week.
Oh, inflation. Let's bring back the days of the Depression. John Maynard Keynes, where are you? Okay, if none of that makes any sense, don't worry. This whole episode will make a lot less sense as we go on.
Yes, so if you are listening to this podcast for the very first time, I would say just turn it off, because this one is a bit more freewheeling than usual. We know that in advance.
Well, okay, let's not tell our listeners to turn it off, but maybe to listen with a bit of advanced knowledge, okay? This is like one of those episodes in a television series where they've been on for multiple seasons and then they do some kind of random episode where it becomes a musical or a dream sequence or something, yeah? We're going to get a bit meta, okay?
We're going to show you how the sausage is made.
Yes, because this is a sausage party. Okay, Sean, we're in the middle of our 1987 miniseries, yeah? The concept is we watch the Best Actress Oscar-nominated films of 1987, and we decide who wins in our books, right?
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
Yeah, I've already decided that we're going to do the voting privately, and we're going to give it to an impartial person to tot up and tabulate the scores. So when we open it up, it'll be a surprise. And for real.
And by tabulate, you mean the one vote from me and the one vote from you.
No, it's going to be... we're going to do it preferentially, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, I haven't told you about this, but
we might as well do it on there.
This
is live in the moment.
Yeah.
Okay, well, good to know. We'll have a preferential ballot.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've already watched one of the films, which was our last episode, Fatal Attraction. And since that time, Sean, we've actually had another encounter with Glenn Close.
Yes, in Stockholm.
Did you find that we were lured into its famous syndrome?
No, darling, because by the end of this movie, I knew who my captors were, and I knew that they were bad people.
Of course, we're talking about The Wife, which many of you may have already seen. It's been out in America for a few weeks. Glenn Close is highly, you know, touted. The odds makers are saying she's the number one currently to win the Best Actress Oscar. You will know if you listened to us the other week that we are some Glenn Close fans, perhaps me more than Sean. Sean, will we be pleased if Glenn Close wins the Oscar for The Wife?
Well, let me tell you, I have actively begun campaigning against her.
Are you serious?
Like,
against her?
It's for her own good, Brian.
You can't just adopt neutrality.
No, because one thing that bothers me more than anything is, one, the overdue Oscar. I hate it. Okay? And two, getting an Oscar for a shit film. Okay?
Yeah, The Wife is not just mediocre,
yeah,
is it?
I can say what I want on my own personal private podcast, okay? These are my views and my opinions. It is a poorly made film. The film is slim, it is simple, it is insulting on many different levels to the craft and skill involved in filmmaking.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's elements of, like, the performances from the cast that are perfectly fine, but they are saddled with a script. I think at one point I turned to you and said, was this written by a computer?
Yeah.
I mean, it literally has, like, an algorithmic quality to how the exposition is explained. And I kind of was waiting for this to be just, like, a mediocre movie where Glenn gets a chance to shine. You know, that maybe she gets, like, one big scene where she delivers it. Well, she gets sort of a version of that kind of scene, but it really didn't land with me.
Yeah, and it's very so poorly directed as well. It's as if the director just turned on the camera and told the actors to walk in and out of frame.
And then kind of like pans to different... Like, it's like, let's pay attention to Jonathan Pryce might be sexually attracted to this photographer girl. Let's just zoom in on the girl while he's talking to someone else to, like, signal to us what to pay attention to. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm not a filmmaker, so I always have to put that caveat out there that I don't really enjoy rubbishing someone else's work, especially how hard, you know, what it takes to get a film made. It's just that if you are lucky enough to be able to helm a picture with a star.
One with Oscar potential.
You know, I just think you have to do a little bit more justice to the craft of filmmaking and to screenwriting.
Okay. Thus ends our marriage with the wife. This is the first time
it's
ever.
It's time for a le divorce.
This is the first time ever that anything to do with Meryl Streep has begun with people talking about Glenn Close. Our second film for 1987 is Ironweed. Yep, that's right, folks. A movie called Ironweed. Have you seen it? Because we have both seen it. We definitely have both seen Ironweed.
Am I right?
Why are you making that little noise? What's that noise about?
You tell me, darling. You tell me.
Okay. I must confess. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa. This never happens. I have not watched the film. Sean,
I was gonna spit the tea out, but I
he doesn't want to damage this highly expensive microphone.
No, I don't. I don't.
No, I okay. That is both sort of true and not true, as Annette Bening would say. Yes and no. I have seen Ironweed. I just saw it, you know, 17 years ago.
So you saw it in 2001?
Oh, God, no. Definitely more years ago than that. I'm terrible with this. I probably saw it in maybe 1995 or 6. That's my guess.
Wow. Princess Diana was alive the last time you saw Ironweed.
It's true. It's true. The iPhone had not been invented, and we were still using dial-up modems I saw Ironweed.
You know, she was dead for years before I was born.
That is not true. Yeah. That is a lie.
No, it's true.
That is a lie. Okay. Listen, I'm coming clean. We do not need to mess up my confession with more lies from you. Okay, so here's the thing. I did see Ironweed at some point when I was in high school, probably around the same time I saw Sophie's Choice. And Sean, I went even further than I did with Sophie's Choice. Not only did I watch Ironweed, I read the book.
Wow, you and Michael Shulman sure are cool people.
I read the book Ironweed by William Kennedy. I was going through this weird period sometime in the like junior, senior year of high school where...
This is your emo phase.
But see, the thing is, like, Brian Mullen's emo phase evolved, like, walking through Barnes & Noble and being like, I know, I'll read some classic American novels that no one pays attention to anymore. Let's pick up Ironweed, and how about something by Eudora Welty? Maybe it was senior year of high school, and I was, you know, finished with all my academic work, and it just like had nothing to do, and I was like, yeah, Eudora Welty, that'll be great. I can literally remember just picking up books that I have absolutely no memory of. I couldn't tell you a bit about the novel of Ironweed, except for the cover. It has this, like, Depression-era photograph on the cover of, like, a guy with long creases in his cheeks and a kind of a floppy hat.
Well, that's the movie.
Okay, you know? Well, so let it be known. I have seen the movie. I just haven't re-watched it now. I was away. I was in Scotland celebrating with some fans of the podcast an acclaimed 40th birthday with Alexandra Cox and David Blasher and others. I hope you're all listening. So I was living it up.
You're name-dropping nobodies here.
Ooh, snap. I think our numbers on iTunes have just depleted by at least two or three. So listen, hun. Okay, so while I was living it up in the Scottish Highlands, Sean was trudging through the mud of Ironweed, and he is going to take the lead on this episode. Now, Sean, we sometimes make reference to the notes, but can you just explain to audiences, usually when we watch the film, we do usually watch it together. Almost always, we watch it simultaneously.
Now, are you asking me, or are you telling me?
I am. I'm asking people for you to explain to people what we usually do.
So what happens is, I do all the technical stuff. I find the film, I project it onto a wall using technology, check all the sound levels, get everything turned off and turned on as appropriate, and then I sit back and do nothing and watch the movie. Whereas you take notes feverishly from start to finish.
And meticulously.
Yeah.
You know, quotations...
Yeah. There was, early on when we started off, I was like, no, I'll take notes too, because what if I see something different? But the thing is, I've realized that I just have a good memory, okay? I keep feelings, like, you know, instinctively close to my heart and bones.
Now, Sean is, I think, actually exaggerating the degree of his memory, because usually, before we sit down and hit record here at the microphone, What usually happens is that I take those 5 pages of notes. It's always at least 5 pages per film.
Well, if I can also reveal another trade secret, you do say that the worse the film is, the more notes you take, because that's how you keep your concentration.
Yeah, so I will have 5 pages of notes. Certainly She-Devil had maybe 5.5.
Chocolat had the most.
I take those notes, and before we hit record, I will often read through them, Sean, usually while you're scrolling through Twitter, but things sink into your brain, and we remind each other of the film that we saw, and thus our seemingly spontaneous conversation is actually, you know, grounded in a foundational knowledge of what we saw, even if it was only a couple of days before, right?
Yeah.
That is not what we're doing today. Sean has seen Ironweed for the first time, and in Sean's hand, you can hear the paper rustling, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In Sean's hand here are the notes that he took. He is going to use these notes as an aide mémoire, and he's going to remind me about what Ironweed is about, because there's just no time. Like, we've got to get this Ironweed out. I mean, they're clamoring for it.
Yeah, and also, let's keep it short, because nobody cares.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Here's the thing, okay. If you asked me, if you held a gun to my head and said, what do you remember of Ironweed from whenever you saw it? Okay.
Okay, go for it.
Okay. I know it has Jack Nicholson and Meryl Streep. I know there's railroads involved. I
feel yes, like very
like,
early on.
Yeah, they're like hobos on a railroad.
In places, yes.
Yeah. They're hobos on a railroad. There's a lot of really sad sack people. Meryl... Does Meryl have, like, a mental issue as well as being a drunk?
Well, you know, some people would say that by virtue of being homeless, you develop various mental issues.
Okay, I just remember Meryl being sort of almost simple in a way
in the
film.
No.
Okay, okay.
She's not simple.
Okay,
she's down on her look, you know.
Okay, then I've made that one up. I literally don't remember anything about the plot, except that there are two very, very depressed people in the or not so depressed, but like the society around them is depressed. They're riding the rails, or he's riding the rails. She's like an on-again, off-again flame of his or something. Of course I remember that she sings a song. I have a memory that that happens in, like, a radio studio?
No.
Okay, that's
no.
wrong. That's wrong. Okay, you're going to tell me what's right.
Yeah, yeah.
did they used to be rich and then they got poor?
Meryl used to be successful-ish. Like, she was...
As a singer?
As a singer, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is part of why that scene where she sings the song is, like, supposedly so emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, clearly I don't remember...
How does it end?
Somebody's gotta die. That's a guess.
Okay.
That's a total guess.
Let's keep on.
Okay, so clearly my memory of, you know, what happened 20 years ago is about as good as Brett Kavanaugh's, but there we go. Sean is now going to read from his contemporaneous notes of having watched the film, and I will react as needed, okay?
Yeah, so please feel free, Brian, to just, you know, scrutinize, question me, you know, not too forcefully, please, you know?
But first of all, did you...
Don't prosecute me.
I certainly won't. Here's my question to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you sat down to watch Ironweed without me. Was it with trepidation? Did you think this is going to be a chore?
Yeah, and it was. It was a real chore. It's the kind of movie that, you know, when it comes out, people see it once and go, gosh, you know, those people sure can act, and then they never, ever will want to see it again, okay? There's a reason nobody talks about this movie, okay? There's a reason it only got 2 Oscar nominations. Well, 2 Oscar nominations is good, but you know what I mean?
Like actor and actress.
Actor and actress. It's not the kind of film you ever need to revisit. It's not really either an essay of the Depression, either.
But at the Kennedy Center Honors felt some reason to, like, make it the centerpiece of their Meryl tribute. This is the second episode in a row where we've mentioned the Kennedy Center Honors.
Maybe they had some, like, crumbling set that, like, nearby that they were like, you know, this looks a bit like Ironweed.
Like, we've just done a production of The Iceman Cometh.
Yeah.
Let's just recycle this because we don't get any funding for the arts at the Kennedy Center.
Well, anyway.
So what you're saying is there's no way in the world that this is one of Meryl's most memorable films or performances?
Well, there's an anecdote that Meryl herself tells that someone, I can't remember who it was, Michael, if you're listening, please just tweet me at this
uh-huh.
part. Meryl has a memory where she meets someone she likes or is well respected or something, and he says, you know, I've always loved you in that movie. Oh gosh, what's it called? And she's waiting for a moment for him to think, and he goes, ah yes, Ironweed. And she's like, Ironweed. Of all the things I've done.
Well, you know, Meryl, when they say on the Kennedy Center, go back and watch the video, when Mike Nichols says, this set from Ironweed, Meryl is definitely gives like a, oh, how wonderful, Ironweed reaction
from
up in the
she
balcony.
Doesn't do like, she doesn't like do side-eye to Dawn and then go, Ironweed.
No, she doesn't. She does her like, I'm performatively grateful kind of performance.
Actually, do you know what? You can have Sophie's Choice if I can have the Devil Wears Prada.
That was a good one.
Wait.
You were in that, too.
Yeah, you know, Annie was in that,
Annie
too.
Annie was in that.
Yeah, she was?
Ladies and gentlemen, Anne Hathaway.
Did you enjoy working with Meryl, Annie?
No.
No? Okay.
No, I loved it.
Oh, and Anne Hathaway is going to sing that song from Ironweed. This will be delightful. Isn't that wonderful, Yo-Yo Ma? You know, that's Meryl at her truly fakest.
Let's get to the notes, shall we?
Yeah, here we go with the notes.
Okay, so the very first thing I wrote is Michael O'Keefe! Exclamation point.
Who's he?
Whoopi Boys!
Is he an Irish actor?
No, he was in Whoopi Boys.
you can explain to anyone
no,
what that is.
No.
Okay, then, look it up.
Nathan Lane,
Nathan Lane is an Ironweed.
Nathan Lane is an Ironweed. So I should say that this film is irritatingly full of ghosts, okay?
Who actual spectral presences.
Their spectral presence is denoted by a white outfit, okay?
Are you serious?
Do you remember this? Yeah.
No, I don't remember.
So Jack Nicholson, who plays a character called Francis.
Uh-huh.
He is haunted by mistakes of his past and incidents and memories, and they come back regularly to like kind of goad him, as it were. And they're all dressed head to toe in white, and they're all ghosts. And sometimes they appear individually, and by the end of the film, they all appear en masse.
That sounds awful. Mm. And Nathan Lane is one of them.
He's one of them. Yeah, he appears early on. So basically, Jack is hard on his luck. He's on like a trolley car or something. He's reliving a moment from his youth, which I should point out. These moments from his youth, the transition from present to past is actually not done very well. In the early stage, I thought this was a different character or somebody else entirely. Like, it was really unclear.
Is it handled better or worse than the Dick Whitman flashbacks in Mad Men?
Much better. No, sorry, much worse. Much worse. No, keep that in. Much worse. Much worse. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. Not better, worse. Like, there's no dissolve or like woo or anything.
Hector Babenka, what were you thinking?
Okay, so screenplay by the author. Is that a good thing? Tom Waits is in this, and as you know, I love when Tom Waits is in anything. He's wonderful as Mr. Renfield in Bram Stoker's Dracula.
He's also in Robert Altman's Shortcuts.
He's great. I love Tom. And Tom Waits is kind of sexy.
Is he good in this?
Yeah, actually he is. I'm so disinterested in actors, male actors.
Uh-huh.
I think Tom Waits, whenever he's acting, really piques my interest.
So is he what? Just like another hobo?
He's another hobo. And I wrote one line. He says, Doc says I got cancer. First thing I ever got. Which is not a Tom Waits impression, but what can you do? So, this film, I said, slow pace, everything taking its time. Jack lamenting at the grave of somebody. Who could be?
Okay. His mother.
Well, we'll find out later, right?
Okay, guess
meandering, okay. Then I'm very confused at this point, because I'm like, oh, there's a strike happening, and, you know, someone gets killed, okay?
I thought you were into labor movements.
No, I'm into labor movements, but I don't know why this is happening or what it has to do. But it's a memory from the past, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. Then I write, Jack goes to dreary soup kitchen, okay? And at this point, he's looking around for a woman. He's like, hey, has anybody seen Helen? Okay. This woman turns up. I say, Meryl is angry. Helen, underlined, to denote her character's name. Doing an accent reminiscent of a homeless Sister Aloysius.
Like, can you give me... I will watch a few scenes of it before this is done, but give me a taste of it.
I can't.
Oh,
like I'm physically and medically, you know.
it would give you polyps.
It would be, yeah. Okay. Bell's palsy, maybe. Okay.
Okay.
I know, I'm not a drunk and I'm not a whore, and I never let a man use me for money. You know, I went Dutch lots of times, and I would let them buy the drinks, but that's because it's a man's place to buy the drinks.
So it says Meryl, former singer, now a bum, okay, gets to sing "He's Me Pal." in a bar. Okay,
wait, already at this point in the movie?
Okay, it's immediately after. So after this soup kitchen incident, there's quite a sad moment where they meet a woman who really looks like she's the death's door outside. Uh-huh. You know, the hospitals won't take her anymore. There's very, very, very little cheeriness in this film. Okay?
Okay.
There's no comic relief. None. Zero. Uh-huh. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So after she's disposed of, okay.
Wait, literally?
Literally.
Okay.
Meryl goes in and sings "He's Me Pal" to the bar. And there's this ludicrous moment, okay, where, you know, Meryl's like, you know, jolling around and she's, you know, she gets down off the microphone. Like, so she sings a song and she basically interacts with the audience where they all like cheer and applaud her and spin around in circles and like she kind of elbows people in that funny way. And, you know, I'm thinking, this is ludicrous. This is actually ludicrous. This better be a dream sequence, okay? And it is, okay?
So she's just having a fantasy.
She's having a fantasy. When she's all over, a couple of people applaud. And I was like, you know what? I wanted this to be a dream sequence, and even still, I'm dissatisfied.
Mm.
Okay?
So just pause, because I think that was Meryl's Oscar clip, right?
It was, yeah.
So, like, it's funny to me that it comes so early in the film.
Yeah.
Does it, like, stand out as a, like, moment that is, like, plucking at your heartstrings in any way that would make you say, wow, this Meryl Streep really can deliver?
Here's the thing, is that, like, everybody in this film is completely down their luck. You know what I mean? It's not as if you get any kind of pathos
mm-hmm.
in this moment, because I'm like, geez, here's a completely desperate, miserable woman singing a song. I don't feel any more sympathy for her because the whole thing is so damn dreary to begin with.
Here's the question. Is this the first time Meryl sang in a movie?
Yeah, I think so, actually, because this is a singing Oscar clip, and Postcards from the Edge is a singing Oscar clip. Into the Woods is also a singing Oscar clip. So they seem to whip these, you know, song numbers out as kind of a way to evidence acting ability, which I always find very funny because, Les Mis aside, people are nearly always lip-syncing to whatever they're singing.
Well, but it's often their own voice.
It's their own voice, but, like, I do find it always a little bit disingenuous.
I guess, so maybe if we're advancing a theory as to why Meryl was rewarded for this film, maybe part of the surprise, in addition to playing drunk, was that she could sing?
Yeah. Now, this is the part where I point out there's a reason why that scene came early on in the film.
Mm-hmm.
It's because her and Jack are barely ever together in this film.
But I've been waiting for them to be together since Heartburn.
Well, keep waiting, okay? This is the first example of my memory of egregious category fraud in the other direction. Meryl Streep is not a leading actress in this film. She's a supporting actress.
Wow.
Yeah. The reason why this film was so unsatisfying is because you're desperately waiting around for the Meryl scenes to appear. And, like, this film just drags on at a lugubrious pace. Did that work correctly?
You definitely
okay,
did.
Good.
Well done.
Thank you.
When you say you're waiting around, is that because when Meryl's there, the film gets a little bit more interesting, or just because you knew you had to do a podcast about Meryl?
The latter, really. but also, like, this film is so up its own arse in terms of, like, how worthy it is, okay? It's like Jack just, like, drags his feet from moment to moment. And so does the director, to kind of say, geez, look how sad and mundane the monotony of their existence is. Listen, I get it, okay? It's
sad. Do
they,
like, have to boil, like, dandelion greens and eat them and stuff like that?
They don't get that far, but they're, like, there are scenes where, you know, he has to jump onto a railroad track or...
Are there any,
you know,
scenes of, like, boils on their feet or any sort of injuries?
There's various shoe moments.
Mm.
Like, he has a piece of string that he uses as a lace and... You know, like, he takes his shoes on and off a couple of times and that kind of stuff.
I'm already getting sense of tedium, so maybe...
I should just roll through this.
Zip through any key moments with Jack Nicholson and then tell me when Meryl comes back.
There's a moment where Jack says to her, at least you got to sing a song. Which Meryl says, this is probably one of the emotive parts where she says, I did what my friend was dying over there, you know?
So you can do
the
accent.
Yeah, I sang a song while my friend was dying over there. Okay?
Can I say, that sounds like a Barbra Streisand impersonation.
But Barbra Streisand meets the Cowardly Lion.
Yeah. Yes! Yeah. If I only had the knife!
If I only had the knife to sing a song, my friend wasn't dying over there.
Okay.
That's a Meryl Streep impression. Actually... I forgot to say something on page one. There's a line where Jack says, "That's as good as it gets." And I wrote that down being like, and I wrote the word prophetic beside it. Which, as you know, I always get very excited when anyone ever references a movie or a song completely by accident. It's like, so during the whole Mueller investigation, you know, when I'm listening to the podcasts and stuff, someone will say, you know, I think we are getting closer to the truth. And I'm like, that's a Cher album, you know? Whenever I hear, I get quite excited.
So was there any point in the film where Meryl said, well, you know, there's been a lot of lies and deception in this Great Depression, but at least there's been one true thing that'd be music to my heart.
Yeah, she says, you know what I've learned my entire life living on the streets? The devil is real and he wears Prada. No, that's not nice. Let's get back to this.
Okay,
nonsense.
Okay.
So Jack and Meryl visit some friend who used to be homeless, who's now not homeless. He's not like affluent or anything, but he's got a roof over his head with his wife, and they come in to kind of warm themselves up. Then Meryl goes behind a curtain and kisses the man, and I write, breath is probably terrible. So this film is agony.
Is this like an old flame, or is Meryl trying to like get something from him?
I think she may get something from him, but what's insinuated at this point is that Meryl has done a little bit of hooking in her life.
Okay, she's a sex worker.
Well,
she dabbles in it.
I think, you know, I think sometimes we're all sex workers when we're really hard up.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So, gets attacked by a crazy guy with cleaver. Oh, no, this is later.
That was a different movie.
This is a memory, okay? This is, yet again, this is a memory which is not presented like a memory. It's presented like the next scene, okay?
Uh-huh.
So Jack is running onto a train, and I'm like, where's Meryl, okay? He has some altercation with some guy, and then he cuts a guy's head open, okay?
Do you think that the weirdness of these memories is an attempt to, like, recreate the damaged psyche of someone whose brain is addled by alcohol? Like, is it a stylistic choice to kind of, like, keep disorienting you? I'm just guessing. I haven't seen the movie since 1995.
If it is, it's not done very well.
Okay.
Okay? But basically, after this incident, we realize it's a memory. The ghost is taunting him again. Jack and Meryl scuffle drunkenly on the street. Get me a sandwich. You're a pain in the ass. Okay?
Who said that?
That's what Jack says to her, and she responds with, you're a pain in the ass. Okay, next thing I've written with a couple of exclamation points at the end of it. It says, Meryl gives homeless guy a hand job.
What?
In a car as he cries and coughs during it. So
wow.
She's giving a hand job as this guy is coughing.
Well, okay, so she clearly got her Oscar nomination for singing and for a hand job.
Yeah.
And that actually predates the blow job that she gives Ed Begley
mm-hmm.
in She-Devil.
Yeah, yeah.
Mark that down in your
calendars.
Your Meryl chronology, yeah. Everybody.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the point in the film where they separate almost permanently.
Really?
Yeah, this is it.
So then we follow Jack?
We follow Jack mostly,
uh-huh.
apart from a few scenes. Here's the scene that I would have chosen for Meryl's Oscar clip.
Uh-huh.
Even though it is totally, totally cliched once again.
Mm-hmm.
So she goes into a church and she prays, she lights candles and she kneels down and she prays and she kind of negotiates with God about all the things that she's done.
Oh, that sounds good.
And I never, ever betrayed anybody. And that's what counts. Of course I know. I know living with Francis was sinful in the eyes of some people, and I took a certain amount of liberty with the commandments of the church. But nobody's going to compel me. I'm not going to declare to anybody, not even you, St. Joseph, that loving Francis was sinful.
So at this point, Meryl is by herself and she's kind of acting by herself. So I will give her a little bit of credit that this is what she has to do solo for most of the
picture. She's literally talking to God like Emily Watson in Breaking the Waves.
I haven't seen that film.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, she has monologues direct to God.
Yeah.
Is that what Meryl's doing?
It is a monologue to God, but it's not. I do this and I don't call it a monologue
to
God.
You talk to God.
Sometimes, you know.
Hello there, God. It's me, Sean.
Yeah, but usually in a church or something.
Out loud?
I don't know, maybe. Mumbling.
I'm learning things every day, folks.
Mm.
Carry on.
So, basically, Meryl, this being a hand job, Meryl did get some money for this.
But she gives the hand job in the church.
No, it was
the
previous.
All right.
Anyway, so what I should have pointed out is that immediately after the handjob, Meryl goes and gets herself a nice, good breakfast, okay? Now, she actually sees a woman who's in the same kind of diner who looks as hard up as she is, and Meryl gives her her toast.
Aww.
She didn't eat, you know, and that's... And that leads her to a moment where she goes into the church and she talks to God, you know? So, like the thing is, I guess,
the way you're describing it makes me think it's actually better than you're saying.
No, but it's the pacing of the film that...
Yeah, but I can see Meryl really selling these moments of, like, giving the lady the toast and then, like, going in the church and, like, having to be exploited mm-hmm. for a man to, like, get whatever she can get. Like, it mm-hmm. has this kind of, like, a Mother Courage mm-hmm. vibe to it, you know?
Yeah, and my favorite scene of the whole film, actually, is when Meryl, because she kind of looks up someone who she used to know back when she was a singer,
mm-hmm.
and she goes and sees her, and this woman is incredibly affluent, you mm-hmm. know? And has also kind of seems to have... acquired some airs and graces as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Meryl is there, and she's clearly a homeless woman talking to this person, and she's saying, "So what are you doing with yourself these days?" She's, you know, Meryl's kind of like, "Well, I was singing for a while, and now I'm homeless," you know, essentially. And basically, Meryl gets no money or no support, no nothing for
these scenes sound like they're full of pathos.
So she gets angry, and then she's thrown out, and then I write, "Vomits on street."
I have to watch this movie.
Yeah. Now, I have to say, this is essentially the end of Meryl in the movie.
The vomit?
No. The last thing she does is she goes, and this is the only nice part of the film, is that she goes and she gets herself a room in a nice boarding house.
How does she get that?
The handjob money.
Oh.
He seemed to really, she must be give really good handjobs, because she got a breakfast and she got like a boarding for like two or three nights.
Things were cheaper in 1930, whatever.
I guess so. You know what? They needed the money, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes you just need to get off.
It's true.
And not from your left hand or your right hand. Mm-hmm. Someone else's hand.
Yeah, especially a nice calloused hand that's been holding a bottle of whiskey.
Yeah, frostbitten, calloused, four-fingered hand.
Carry yeah. on.
Okay, so do you want me to go into the Jack parts now?
I mean, not really. Yeah. I can guess. There's a bunch of ghosts. There's some past trauma. Do we reveal, like, whose gravestone it was?
Yeah, so I can tell you all this.
Oh, a dead son. That's it. Yeah.
So basically, Jack has been married before, and he's had more than one child, but there was a young one who he dropped the kid, and the belief was that Jack dropped him when he was drunk.
Mm.
But Jack kind of claims this day he wasn't drunk, it was an accident, and mm-hmm. it was just a tragedy for everyone. And he shows up, so he's worked half a day and he gets enough money and needed this courage, and he goes to the house that he used to live in to see his ex-wife, or actually I think she still might be his wife, you know.
Okay.
And he brings a turkey to Aww. Her because it's like Christmas? I don't know. It's like time to eat turkey anyway.
Thanksgiving, possibly?
Possibly, yeah. You know, he meets his grandchild. At first I was really confused because I was like, but wait, the kid died when he was a baby. How can he have grandchildren? I'm like, oh, he has other children, okay? So that part really confused me for a little while, okay? But anyway, and... Jack used to be a baseball player. That's what I realized.
Oh, so it's all about, you know, the American dream going sour.
Very much so, very much so. And then there's all these scenes where, oh yeah, this is the part where I almost cried. For some reason, I was very emotional on the Sunday that you came home from Edinburgh.
Probably because I wasn't around and you were longing for my company.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we all know how it turned out. Anyway, so I think I was watching Joan Rivers clips and getting upset for some reason.
So you were in a state.
I was in a bit of a state, okay?
Okay.
So the one scene in which I get emotional is when they go to Jack's son's bedroom.
Aww.
And it's preserved as it was, and all this kind of like afternoon light is dappling every surface in the room.
Aww.
And it looks clean and warm and inviting, and it's just sad. So
can I say one thing?
I got kind of emotional during that moment.
Here's my thing. So this movie was based on a novel by someone mm-hmm. named William Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
who also wrote the screenplay.
Uh-huh.
The way you're describing it, there's a kind of strain of, don't take this the wrong way, Irish miserabilism. Do you know what I'm saying? Like the kind of pathos of like the dead son and the like talking to God and the like we're going to trudge through. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying this is real to Irish people, but in terms of like Irish literature and Irish plays and things, I feel like there's a lot of this kind of trope.
Well, you know, we had it hard for quite a while.
No, I know. And I'm saying that like, so I feel literally. Like William Kennedy is tapping into, and you know, Eugene O'Neill does this as well. It's just kind of like, kind of a sense that like, our lot in life on this vale of tears is ultimately to suffer, you know? So maybe that is tapping into something deep in your soul, Sean.
Maybe. Maybe. I think I understood why, you know, I got upset about this part, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the only Jack moment that I care to enumerate. Blah, blah, blah. He reconciles with his family, more or less. Okay?
So this is like the big plot turning point.
This is the big plot turning point. And Helen, who's played by Meryl, is just nowhere to be seen. Oh, no. Every so often, they'll just go to a clip of her, like brushing her hair or something, you know,
in this hotel room.
Yeah, and boarding house.
So, oh yeah.
So then, and that's it. That's all we get. And so Meryl then gets absolutely pissed drunk, okay, when she's not with Jack. So maybe let me just go back to the notes here, okay?
Yeah.
So Mrs. Doherty flashback, woman totally nude in hat, okay? Yeah.
Yes. So there's a. Is it a nice hat?
It's a big, wide brimmed kind of like Sunday hat, and she's completely, totally naked, like with the pubic triangle and everything.
Who is she?
So there's flashbacks to his youth. Now I thought this was Michael O'Keefe from the Whoopi Boys, but no, it turns out Michael O'Keefe from the Whoopi Boys is his eldest son, who's not happy that he's there. You know.
Uh huh.
You know, great Santini.
Who's the naked woman?
So this is a woman who he worked for. Who appears? She comes out walking. It's a bit like she's unaware that she's totally butt naked, and he's looking at her naked body in kind of a memory, you know.
Sounds like a really memorable scene. Meryl and Jack ever get back together?
Yeah. Well, so once he kind of reconciles with his family, he goes back to see Helen. Now this is interesting because when Helen has a bath and gets tidied up, do you know who she looks like?
Mamie Gummer.
Well, yeah, by extension, yes. She looks like Meryl Streep. This is the thing. This is the interesting thing. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, it's Meryl. You know what I mean?
Can I say,
it's Meryl.
Your blow-by-blow of this description is making me think Meryl actually did deserve the nomination for this role. It's really like, I know you're saying that she didn't have a lot of screen time, but the time that she has seems like it gives her moment after moment. She sings a song. She talks to God. She's sexually exploited in order to gain money. She, like, confronts an affluent woman. And then she kind of glams up a bit. And we realize, oh, actually, underneath all the encrusted soot, she's still Meryl. Like, that's at least five stations of the cross that I'm willing to accept are solid. I have to watch some of these scenes.
Listen, I get it. It's just that I'd be more interested to see who didn't get an Oscar nomination this year.
Okay, sure.
You know what I mean? That's my biggest takeaway from this whole thing, is that this is Meryl in the early stage of taking things from other people.
Okay, you know, possibly.
Because, listen, I'm not saying that she's not good. I'm just saying that she doesn't deserve to be a best actress.
Yeah, but you know what? They probably realize that it was good for her to be nominated in the same category as her former co-star, Cher, so that then they could have that cute moment where Cher talks about being in a film with Mary Louise Streep.
Yeah. So Meryl has a bath, looks like Meryl Streep for the first time in the movie, appears to be hammered. Then it goes, end of movie, Meryl collapsed on the floor at the end.
Wait, she dies?
No, no, I paid attention to this moment to see if she was dead. She appears to be breathing.
Wait. So she gets glammed up. She collapses on the floor.
She doesn't get glammed up. She just has a bath.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
She's a clean bath. And then she collapses?
Yes.
Is Jack Nicholson there?
Yes. He comes to the boarding house. He finds out where she is. And it's like after he's reconciled. This is interesting, I suppose.
Uh-huh.
After he's reconciled with his family, he kind of goes to sort out the other things in his life. You know
like
what I mean?
Like her.
Like her, yeah. Because he does care for her.
What does she collapse from? Like cirrhosis of the liver?
No, just like she's pissed. She's pissed or she has a bottle of whiskey or something.
And then does he help her?
He lies on the floor with her.
And that's the end.
Yeah, but so she doesn't have any of the lines with him at this point because she's completely comatose.
Nathan Lane comes as a ghost.
And says, they're me pals, they're me pals.
No, he looks at her and he says, isn't she great? Okay, Sean, I think we have to pause. I have to watch a couple of scenes just to see, okay?
Yeah.
And then I'll report if I agree with you. Let's watch a little bit of Iron Man.
Cue the clips, Brian. Cue the clips.
I used to hear you on the radio, but then I lost track. What have you been doing?
Well, I went on concert tour as a pianist. And then I was abroad for years. Living in Paris and Vienna. And everywhere.
Oh, exciting. What an exciting life. I envy you, Helen. I really do. I never go anywhere. Are you staying with your brother while you're here?
Well, I suppose. We're very close.
I saw him in church only last week.
In church?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that.
I go past his home all the time. It's
hypocrite.
So...
What's he doing in church after what he did to me?
What?
Well, you know, he and my mother, they stole all the money my father left me.
No.
Oh, yes, that's right. For 15 years, you see, they hid the will.
Oh, I'm so
11
sorry.
Of those years I knew. I'm sorry, but you'll have to leave.
Sorry.
You're sorry for me.
But you're making
I
much
knew.
Too much
I
much
wanted to be free. Nice. Even if it had, I had to suffer for it. All right. I got even. I left him with the peacock there. Thieves, they were.
Well, that was the shortest movie I've ever seen.
Did I like it? You throwing up?
Sean's representation of the film was accurate to a certain extent. I have to admit, it's surprising to say it, Brian, who is usually the one who is all down on Meryl Streep, I can see it. I can see why Meryl Streep deserved an Oscar nomination for the roles, at least in the scenes that I just watched. She is doing a kind of funny, grumbling voice. I would actually say less like Sister Aloysius and more like Popeye. She's kind of, do you know how Popeye's trying to talk to her and
yeah.
Can't quite understand what he's saying, kind of what she's doing under her breath. And it's a kind of weird situation that I've just been through to watch all the Meryl Streep scenes one after the other. It kind of just shows you, in this movie, most of her scenes are sort of by herself.
Yeah, it also shows you that even people on YouTube know that there's only a few moments where she gets to do anything in the film.
No, I know, but I guess what I'm saying is, like, this is a movie where it requires Meryl to be solo in many ways. Like, I have to admit, I found that He's My Pal scene impressive. It's impressive that Meryl is giving that vocal performance, which is strong and full of gusto, and then when we see the real version, her voice is thin and reedy, and in the fantasy version, Jack Nicholson applauds her and kisses her and loves her.
Yeah.
And she's singing about him.
Yeah.
Right? She's singing about how much she loves him.
Yeah.
And then in the real version, he's barely even paying attention or applauding. And she's getting absolutely zero reaction. So I guess, like, yes, it's totally heavy-handed. But there's real pathos here in her performance. And I would say also, she does seem to be playing a woman with... like a degree of mental illness.
Oh, for sure.
Or at least like mental illness that has been brought about by really hard circumstances and alcohol abuse.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah? For sure.
She's like wandering through the streets in one of those scenes after coming out of the bar, kind of mumbling to herself. And when she confronts that rich woman, she's kind of saying, yeah, you see, my brother is a hypocrite. He stole everything from me. He and mother stole the money that was meant to go to me. Like, she's a really damaged person.
Yeah, she's raving.
And she wants Jack Nicholson to be her savior.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene with God, which she's talking about, is saying,
yeah,
you know, I know it was sinful to live with Francis, or sinful in some people's eyes, but he's the one for me, or something, she says.
Yeah. And I also made a factual error.
Yes, and
yeah.
Actually, a surprise.
I must have looked down to have taken a note during this part.
Well, because Sean made a factual error that actually is a bit blasphemous, right? Meryl is praying to God, and when she's done praying, what does she find, Sean?
She finds money on the ground. And we don't know how much it is.
It looks to me like at least a $10 bill, possibly a $20.
Yeah? But I assume she got some money for the hand job.
Nope. I just watched the scenes. No money for the hand job.
So just for fun. Just pure enjoyment, is it?
Sean, it's a gift from God. She's pure of heart. I thought you understand how ordinary miracles happen
every day.
But no, honestly, Sean, you yourself have had this experience. I don't know if we've ever mentioned this on the podcast. What happened to you, the miracle of Provincetown?
Oh, God, I found $20, okay?
In?
Which,
ATM.
Which in Provincetown gets you basically a cup of coffee.
Yes, but let it be noted that Sean found $20 in this ATM, and then every time we were walking down a commercial street, we had to look at this ATM in case there was $20 more in the same ATM. So I'm surprised you couldn't relate that to Meryl, you know?
Yeah, but, yeah.
Yeah. You've been totally dismissive of Ironweed. I understand you had to watch the whole thing. I just watched the 10-minute supercut. Okay, maybe Meryl was a supporting actress in terms of screen time. There have been some Best Actress winners with very little screen time.
Mm-hmm.
Frances McDormand in Fargo, definitely one of them.
Yeah, Kate Winslet in The Reader.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in terms of actors, Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs.
True, yeah.
Right? So it's not necessarily always about screen time.
No, I know that. I know that.
And she's clearly the female lead of the film,
for
right?
For sure.
Okay. Well, I have to say that, Meryl, I found you pathetic, but in the best possible way, seeing that you elicited pathos.
Very good.
It's interesting, Meryl and Jack, did they ever work together again?
Well, they'd worked together on Heartbeat, or whatever it's called, Heartbreak.
Heartburn.
Heartburn.
But no, did they ever do it again, or was Ironweed the end of it?
I'm thinking, I think that's it.
Mm.
Yeah.
We might need to fact check, but I'm pretty sure.
I'm going to say yeah.
I'm pretty sure that was as good as it got.
Yeah.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode, because I'm sure none of you are going to go watch Ironweed.
Yeah, you know what? We should have some kind of satanic invocation right
what?
Now. Because no,
Paimon.
Because no one's listened this far. You know what I mean?
If an Ironweed falls in the woods and nobody's there to hear it, does it make a vomiting sound? All right, well, we've gotten through Ironweed, and I have to say, this was the one we were dreading when we picked this 1997 year. We thought to ourselves, well, there's possibly one dud, and that dud has passed. It's like, it's a bit like passing a kidney stone. The pain is over, and now we can enjoy some news, some broadcast news.
Yes.
We promise this is one that we will both rewatch again in order to experience Holly Hunter in her Oscar-nominated role, opposite Albert Brooks and William Hurt.
And Jack Nicholson.
And Jack Nicholson. And
it?
One of your favorite unsung Oscar heroines, Debbie Jelinski.
Oh my God!
Joan Cusack is in broadcast news.
Did she get an Oscar nomination for this?
I don't know. We'll have to check. I don't think so. I think her Oscar nominations are In and Out,
Working Girl,
and Working Girl.
Oh.
Yeah. But
what an icon.
We'll see. We love Joan Cusack.
We do.
We are fans of Holly Hunter.
Yeah, let's do an invocation to Satan now in honor of Joan Cusack.
Okay, you can start.
Okay.
Just say, don't you have to say things backwards? Isn't that how it works?
Yes.
I mean, you know more about satanic cults than I do. Go ahead, invoke.
Okay, starting now. No, I don't.
We'll do that off mic. Yeah. How about that?
Yeah.
In the meantime, Sean, if people want to invoke us on Twitter, how can they do so?
Well, I'm at Sean McGovern X, and you're at BA Mullen Speaks, and the podcast itself is at Broad Appeal Pod.
And Broad Appeal is the name of the pod. You can find us on iTunes, where we hope you'll subscribe, also on Stitcher. And why don't you leave us a rating or a review?
Also, if you really want to find old episodes, if you type in Podomatic Broad Appeal into Google, you'll find our host page, which is every single episode we've ever done up there.
Do you know how many there are?
57.
Good one, very close. This is our 56th episode,
cool.
And that's not counting the three-parters.
Yeah.
So we have been trudging along just like those hobos.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? It's not over yet.
Oh, yeah.
All right, we'll be back and bringing you the news, the broadcast news from 1987.
Okay, stay tuned. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. He's me pal. He's me pal. There ain't nobody else I can see. I know he's dead tough, but his love is no bluff. He'd share his last dollar with me, wouldn't ya? I'd rather be his with his 15 a week than be some old millionaire's girl. He's the best, and I love him.